Good afternoon, everyone. I call this Health and Social Services Committee for the Senate to order at 1:30 p.m. February 8, 2022. We're meeting today in room 205 of the Capitol Building. Please remember to silence your cell phones as a courtesy. Committee members present today are Senator Reinbold, Senator Hughes, Senator Baggage, myself, Senator Wilson. We do have a quorum to conduct business. Senator Casella was excused on other state business this afternoon. This afternoon, we'll finish an update from Department of Health and Social Services and the Office of Information Technology presentation on cyber attacks and cybersecurity. Then we'll take up SB 132, examination of vets from the veterinarians from the PDMP, Prescription Database Monitoring Program. And then we'll take a presentation from last Thursday, HB 133, an update on the ABLE Act. Today we have before us Solomon Robb, Assistant Commissioner of DHSS, and Scott McCulchin, I'm sorry if I mispronounced your name, from the Department of their Technology Officer. Also available for questions is, I think we have Bill Smith. Also here in the room, our Chief Information Officer. In order to get through, make sure we have enough time to get through the presentation and all the other business, we'll just ask members to parking lot your questions to the end of the presentation, and then we'll go through committee questions. We'll call up our department presenters from the Department of Health to come on up, and you may just remember to put yourselves on the record, and you may begin when you're ready.
Thank you, Chair Wilson and members of the committee. We appreciate the opportunity to be here this afternoon. For the record, I'm Sylvan Robb, the Assistant Commissioner with the Department of Health and Social Services. And with me is Scott McCutcheon.
Hello, my name is Scott McCutcheon. On the record, I am a Department Technology Officer for Health and Social Services.
So just before we dive into the slides, I just wanted to provide a little bit of context to the committee. To remind the committee that the entire Department of Health and Social Services.
I'm sorry, we'll take a brief at ease.
Can we fix that echo?
Well, we're back on the record.
Again, for the record, Sylvan Robb. So I did just want to remind committee members that the entire Department of Health and Social Services is a HIPAA-covered entity. And that comes with a great deal of compliance requirements that are more stringent than what many other departments are required to adhere to. So to the extent possible, we take advantage of all the services that the Office of Information Technology provides to the state enterprise-wide, but there are some things that we require in a HIPAA-compliant way that are not offered by OIT. And just to give you a sense of the scope of the IT services at HESS, we have about 600 servers that we manage, operating about 350 different applications. So as a reminder, I'm sure probably all of you remember when this happened, but the timeline for when this started, on May 5th, folks in CIO Smith's shop noticed that there was malicious activity happening within some elements of the HESS system, and they notified us. Those impacted systems were taken offline immediately, and we set up an incident response team, as well as notifying law enforcement of the intrusion. Then by the 10th, we realized that we were up against a very sophisticated actor, and so we reached out to retain a contractor who is experienced globally in providing these kinds of services. They have helped governments, multinational corporations, and others globally respond to cyber attacks, and they were very helpful in us with our reaction. The next day, with their assistance, we identified some additional elements of our system that did have indications of compromise, and those were also taken offline. And by May 17th, we felt that we'd found all of the impacted systems from the attack, and all of those were offline and isolated to protect the rest of the system. The first press release was held on May 18th, And we notified the public via that press release as well as on social media, because one of the impacted elements was the department's website. So the big question is kind of what was impacted. There were 19 different systems that were taken offline by the attack. Many of them you probably wouldn't be familiar with. As I mentioned, we do have 350 different applications. But some that you may have had awareness of were our background check unit, the AK AIMS, which is where behavioral health data are entered through the system, as well as our grants management system for the department, and also the database at Vital Records. So we went through and notified. The way HIPAA is written, it requires, and I'm going to read this, if I may, Mr. Chair, that there is a low probability that information was not compromised. So that's the threshold. If we cannot feel confident that we're meeting that threshold, then we're required to notify of a breach. And so that happened in September. We notified Alaskans. We did engage a credit monitoring service and offered that to all Alaskans in September. And moving on, I'll let Mr. McCutcheon really talk about how one responds to a cyber attack, and this is using sort of nationally recognized best practices for how to respond in these situations.
Thank you, Sylvan. For the record, Scott McCutcheon, DTO, DHSS. So standard cyber attack response phases were followed by DHSS. I'll go over them. There's really three major steps and phases in cyber attack response. First one was detection and analysis, where we determined the scope of the intrusion and whether it was ongoing. We determined the earliest data compromise and the cause of the intrusion. And we developed an incident containment and attacker eradication plan. That really completes the first phase of the detection and analysis. Then we move on to the second phase, which is the containment, eradication, and recovery phase. We isolate then the infected systems and disable compromised accounts. We reset privileged account passwords across the enterprise. We rotated passwords on privileged accounts every other day to minimize potential reinfection. Then we deployed additional malware across the enterprise that was designed by our vendor to really focus on looking for indications of compromise across our enterprise. The next and last phase is the post-incident recovery. That's where we reviewed and improved server and application hardening processes as recommended by the vendor. We implemented code scanning of our software applications prior to bringing them back up into production. And we conducted penetration testing of each application or server, meaning that we pretended in a design, we pretended that we were an outside hacker looking at that system and searched for vulnerabilities. That way we could provide a reasonable assuredness that we were bringing a production system back online that was ready to be exposed to the internet again.
Thank you. For the record, this is Sylvan Rahm. So looking ahead to our path forward, it's been obviously a long time since May when this incident first started. And I am happy to report that since last week, we could update the slide. We've actually had 11 systems restored so far. So those include the systems I mentioned earlier, our background check unit, Vital Records, AK AIMS, as well as our grants management system. We have 8 systems that are in stages of restoration. And as Mr. McCutcheon was mentioning, that is a 23-step process that they go through in order to restore those systems. So it has been a timely process, to say the least. And as we're bringing things back online, you know, everything is being hardened. We're ensuring that things are more robust than they were when the attack happened. And then finally, I would just note that one of the things the department is very interested in doing is an item that's in the Fast Track Supplemental, and that's to do what's called a security program assessment And in that, we would hire a contractor to assess our entire system, looking for any additional vulnerabilities, and, you know, really working with us to figure out how to make the system as robust and secure as it can be. And so we're hopeful to be able to conduct that activity in the near future. And that brings us to the end of our presentation, Mr. Chair, so we're happy to answer any questions.
We first have a question by Senator Baggage, followed by Senator Reinbold, then Senator Hughes.
Fantastic. My question was answered.
All right. Senator Reinbold, then Senator Hughes.
I actually didn't have my hand up, but I'm going to go ahead and ask it. No. But anyway, it just, I don't know what you're allowed to and not allowed to tell us about who the attacker was, and that may be an executive session or whatever, but it's just, and then I'm going to make a little comment too. Just having someone monitor their credit is nothing like a bad actor getting all of their data. So that's, it just doesn't seem good enough for me, you know, if somebody knows all your private information, especially if it's mental health issues and medication issues, and I mean, even grant issues. To me, it's highly confidential. To know who has this information is pretty important, and I think they have the right to know who their attacker was. So, and I just feel like more needs to be done.
Through the chair to Senator Reinbold, we can say that the attacker was a very sophisticated state-sponsored actor. Law enforcement would prefer that we not provide more details.
State-sponsored?
Meaning out of a nation state.
Okay, that's exactly what I thought you meant. So I just, that's amazing. So it was a foreign attacker that now has this private data of these individuals. I just think this is very serious, and I just hope we do more for the people. And we take cybersecurity far more seriously.
Sandra Hughes.
Yes, I was obliging the chair's request that we park questions in the parking lot. So maybe I misunderstood this, but I on slide 2, the public was notified, which was 13 days after the malicious activity was detected. But then you said something about September. Did I misunderstand? What did you say about September?
Through the chair to Senator Hughes, you did not misunderstand. So you are correct that the first notification to the public of the cyber attack was on May 18th. And then in September was when we alerted people to the HIPAA breach. And we held on to that information, again, at the request of our partners in law enforcement. They didn't want us to tip our hand by making the HIPAA notification. So.
Could I tease that out a little more fully, Mr. Chair?
Yes, and when you say state partners, are you talking state law enforcement or federal law enforcement?
Through the chair, this is Scott McCutcheon for the record. Mr. Chair, the law enforcement agencies are basically spanning both state and federal authorities, so we are working with a number of law enforcement. I think the other important thing to point out is that it's part of an overall ongoing investigation across the United States. And so they've asked us to make sure that we don't try to provide any additional information than minimum.
Thank you. Senator Hughes.
So there was a general notice on May 18th, which is 13 days, which is a number of days in itself that people might want to be monitoring their personal accounts and things had they known earlier. But then it's not until September 18th, the HIPAA notice. So the May 18th was general, social media, press. Was the September when you actually let the particular people know? I know people were notified that their data was breached. And if so, why did we wait, let's see, June, July, 4 months before we let particular people know that their information was specifically breached?
Through the chair to Senator Hughes, that's certainly an understandable question. Again, we waited to make the notification at the request of law enforcement because, as Mr. McCutcheon noted, there was an active investigation that is still continuing. Because of the nature of the attack, and the breadth of the services that are provided by Health and Social Services, individuals were notified using the PFD database because that's kind of the most comprehensive database available for the state. So we did notify all Alaskans.
And just as a follow-up, I guess it would be a question for law enforcement at some point, because if your personal data is breached, mine is, I would like to know as soon as possible. And I understand sometimes they have to withhold because of an investigation, but still it seems like people needed to be alerted so they could be monitoring everything within their own power. So, yeah, I guess that's the question for law enforcement, unless you can give you already kind of gave that canned answer, but I'm really curious why individuals wouldn't know earlier. I mean, when our houses are robbed, yeah, there's an investigation, but we know our houses are robbed. So it's just odd to me that was withheld so long.
And before you answer Senator Hughes' question, can you also throw in, what's the time frame? Is there a time frame for HIPAA notifications to go out when there's a known breach?
Mr. Chair, there is a required notification that's part of the HIPAA requirement. You are allowed to delay notification if it would impact a law enforcement investigation to do so. And so when the notification was made was when we were required to do so under that, under HIPAA.
Senator Reinbold.
And thank you to the chair. We can make this assumption that Social Security numbers, addresses, names, kids' names, diagnoses, all this stuff is out there in the hands of a foreign bad actor. Is that correct?
Through the chair to Senator Reinbold, the threshold for the HIPAA notification is that we can't assert that there's a low probability that those items were not taken. And so due to the nature of the attack, we can't say with certainty what was. But those are items that of data that the department does have for some individuals.
Senator Reinbold?
So we can, I mean, it's pretty obvious. Assumption that can be made. How many people were impacted?
Through the chair to Senator Reinbold, we did notify all Alaskans. As I mentioned, again, we don't have the ability to say specifically, that your information was taken, but Senator Wilson's was not or something to that effect, which is why we notified everyone.
Through the chair.
I guess the question is, how many could have been exposed records?
300,000, roughly? Is that how many are on public assistance? Or is it way beyond that?
Through the chair. I think the answer to that is that it's an undetermined amount of data that was involved in the possibility of a HIPAA breach. The fact is, we don't know what kind of data was exfiltrated. But following HIPAA rules, as Sylvan mentioned, we cannot prove that it was not taken. So we have to report under the HIPAA law. So basically, if you were going to look at the overall extent, it would be the department data input.
And roughly, how many Alaskans did you notify of the HIPAA breach?
Mr. Chair, we notified all those individuals who were part of the permanent fund database. And again, just to be clear, it had nothing to do with Department of Revenue or the permanent fund. That's just an extremely comprehensive and up-to-date body of contact information.
You notified all Alaskans that received a dividend?
Yes, sir.
Okay. And that would have been, they would have received a dividend in FY20, or was that 21,
20? Mr. Chair, it was the current database, so we received the data from them in September. And again, they were doing a favor to us by partnering with us, so we want to be clear that there was no indication of any, compromise of permanent funds database. We just wanted to be as comprehensive as possible in our notifications, and they tend to have a very comprehensive and up-to-date database.
Senator Reinbold.
Okay. Thank you. And through the chair, this is kind of important. I mean, because that would, I think, is about 675,000 people now that got notified that their data might have been compromised. But to not even give us the most basic number that we're looking for. Is this public assistance? We know is about 300,000 people. We've been around and around in regards to this. Then there's the vital statistics. There's all this, all these other programs. I think you said 13 programs and 600 servers, something like that. I mean, it's about half the population, it sounds like, that got their data most likely compromised and taken. And just going around and around and around, not being able to give us a number of, it just feels like you're hiding something. I mean, I'll be straight up with you. It feels like you're evading us, and we're not asking hard questions. These are constituents that we have to deal with. And so if you guys could at least help us out a little, you know, with a number, you know, we're not asking for specific names and all that kind of stuff, but give us a target at least.
Through the chair, Senator Reinbold, we certainly don't mean to seem evasive. It truly is a situation that even with the assistance of our contractor, who's experienced in this globally, we are unable to identify the exact number of people whose data may have been taken.
You didn't say exact.
I guess that, you know, from my understanding, what you're saying is that there could have been data from current and there could have been data from past, and it's hard to get that information of the past folks to get that. And I understand. You said you restored in 11 systems, and how many do you have left to restore?
Mr. Chair, we have 8 that are currently in the process, that 23-step process of being restored, and then we have 4 more that are still waiting to have their restoration started.
Do we have a time frame of those additional programs coming online?
I will defer to Mr. McCutcheon.
Go ahead.
Scott McCutcheon, for the record. Mr. Chair, because each system is being essentially rebuilt from the ground up, as part of our cyber attack restoration process, an accurate timeline to restore an application we can't really provide from an IT planning perspective. We're not simply restoring from a data archive tape or something like that. So I would say that it will be several more months of effort for our operations and our network teams and our business applications to restore those services.
And with those additional systems yet to come on board, do we have a estimate of a cost for those additional systems, of what that cost is going to, our final bill? I understand that this year in the budget, you do have some costs for the systems that you already brought back online in terms. Will there be an additional supplemental ask from the administration to incur any more costs for these remaining systems to be brought back online?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As you correctly noted, there is a supplemental item in this year's budget for the cyber attack that is inclusive of the cost to restore the additional systems that have not currently been brought back online. And just as a reminder, so it's $2.4 million of new UGF funds, and we do have federal matching for a portion of that.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Senator Reinbold.
Thank you. Through the chair, and apologize if I missed this, but it says DHSS proposes the security program assessment that will provide recommendations to lower the risk. I mean, obviously, there's still going to be some risk. When is that going to be complete? Not only is the assessment, I mean, I know you asked for $4 million, it sounds like, but when do you think it's actually going to be a secure database?
Through the chair to Senator Reinbold, so having that security program assessment conducted, that's an item that's in the Fast Track Supplemental. And so as soon as we have access to those funds, we are very ready to spring forward and get that work done, because we are as anxious to have this done as you are.
I'll look, Senator Reinbold.
So it's $4 million just to have an assessment done, and then we don't know how much more it's going to cost to actually have security for all these hundreds of thousands of people that have done the database. Is that what I'm hearing, that this is only the first step after almost a year of the attack?
Through the chair to Senator Reinbold, I apologize if I was confusing. The item in the Fast Track Supplemental for the security program assessment is $1.9 million.
Okay, that wasn't my question.
I'm going to rephrase your question, Senator.
It was just, let's just say 1.9, and then you said there was matching federal funds, I believe is what you said, but that the cost is not what I'm asking about. The cost is when, it sounds like that's just the assessment. I want to know when it's actually going to, you know, when the database is secure. I mean, it sounds like you need an assessment, and then you're probably going to need more money, and then you probably need time to implement that. And that in the meantime, we don't know how risky our data is right now.
Through the chair to Senator Reinbold, the $1.9 million for the security program assessment, we were actually trying to be proactive. So the cost of the assessment is $400,000, and the additional $1.5 would be to allow us to make whatever improvements to harden the system are recommended by through that assessment.
Ms. Senator Reinbold?
Thank you. That's what I was getting to. Thank you.
All right. Any further questions? Any last comments?
We appreciate the opportunity to update the committee on our recovery period.
All right. Well, thank you again for the presentation. We'll take a brief at ease, and we'll ask Senator Holland, sponsor of SB 132, to come on up. We are back on the record. Our next item of business is SB 132, Controlled Substance Data Exempt for Veterinarians. We do have the bill sponsor before us, and are there any final questions for the bill sponsor? We also have a litany of experts in the room or on the phone to answer questions from Director Chambers and the Executive Administrator of DECED as well. And Justin Ruffridge, the State Board of Pharmacy, is also online, as well as an expert in veterinarian law as well, in the room as well. Senator Holland, do you have any final statements?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Senator Holland, Senator Roger Holland, District 10. No, thank you all so much for hearing this important bill. The PDMP is a very valuable program in the state of Alaska. For medical purposes, tracking opioid overdoses and whatnot. But we just try to make the argument that we just want to do what 34 other states in the United States have done and exempt veterinarians because it does not work well with the veterinary program. But thank you so much for hearing this bill.
Thank you, sir. And with that, is there a motion from the committee? The will of the committee? Senator Hughes.
May I make a comment first?
Yes.
First of all, I want to thank Senator Begich for bringing to our attention the fact that veterinarians don't fall under the HIPAA requirements. And having been around clinics where my husband worked, you know, on humans, their computer screens are required to be only visible if you're sitting directly in front of them. So not only in the current situation are we exposing veterinarians and their staff to seeing information that should be HIPAA protected, but we're also exposing that to the public and people that may come into the vet clinic. So I just want to point that out, that I do think that is a great reason to take care of this. But I wanted to say it's too bad it wasn't harder to convince us. And because I told some of the veterinarians, I think what you need to do is hold a reception where you bring puppies and kitties. and that would help convince us. But I'm the case you laid out, in the case of veterinarians laid out, satisfied our questions. But I do want to thank you for bringing the bill forward.
All right. Senator Hughes.
And with that, Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 132, version 32-LS0861A, from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Is there objection? Seeing or hearing none, Senate Bill 132 moves from committee. We'll take an at ease to sign the paperwork and get our next piece of legislation before the committee, which is HB 133, if the bill sponsor wants to come up and replace Senator Holland. Take an at ease. All right, we are back on the record. We are now going to move on to our last item of business for today, which is HB 133. We do have Rhett Fields, the bill sponsor, here to briefly give us a quick reintroduction of the bill. We also have to finish invited testimony, which we have Michelle Gott, the executive director of Hope Resource Center, and Patrick Skinner, the attorney at Disability Law, also available on the phone for questions, as well as Pam Leary, the estate investment officer and program coordinator for ABLE. Representative Fields, floor is yours.
Thanks, Chairman Wilson. Again, this is an ABLE Act update, taking advantage of Zach Fields for the record. Thank you, Chairman Wilson, for the opportunity to be back here. Presenting a labor and commerce bill to update the ABLE Act. The update is necessary because there were federal changes to the law that occurred after the state of Alaska established its ABLE program, making the potential account sizes larger, introducing flexibility for moving, say, a 529 savings account into an ABLE account, updating the age at which a disability occurs. So these additional flexibilities are really important, as we heard from invited testifiers the other day, and appreciate the opportunity to continue looking at this bill in the committee.
Brief eddies. Yeah, brief eddies. All right, we're back on the record. Senator Hughes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When I work on my newsletter, I sometimes like to talk about what's happening in committees, and so I brought up what was happening in this committee, including this bill. And when I was doing a little searching, I actually Googled, because I couldn't remember if you said we were allowing, by lifting the age limit, it would allow the federally authorized age. I thought there was some mention of that age being 49. And so my question is that accurate? Because I could not find that. And maybe that was a discussion at the federal level, but maybe they have not yet done that. But everything that I saw, and you know how you can do a search and you can narrow it to the last year or the last month, everything that I saw was age 26 as far as the federal law. So has it actually been changed, age 49?
Thank you. Through the chair, yes, it has. And the age is actually 46, not 49. But the way that we wrote this bill is, rather than naming an age, we wrote it to conform to the federal law. So if the federal government goes back and says, oh, okay, now it's actually 49, our law will automatically be updated as well.
Senator Hughes?
Okay. I will do a Google then with 46, but everything that I brought up, and without even putting in an age, was just ABLE age, you know, eligibility, and everything said 26. So perhaps it's in regulation, the age 46. And
through the chair, perhaps I could turn to my staff, Tristan Walsh.
Yes. For the record, Tristan Walsh, staff representative Fields. Senator Hughes, through the chair, I actually was reviewing the hearings from the prior session from the prior sponsor, and I believe what has happened is that the federal legislation was debated but not finalized, and so they were looking at raising it to age 46. And so what this bill intended to do was make sure that our state statute was reflexive and would be corresponding to whatever change the federal government made. So that was an error on our part for the statement of the sexual analysis, if it stated it there.
It's just good. So at this point it is 26, with hope that it'll be raised. Okay, I just wanted to get that some alignment there is what was going on, and I thought we might have some misinformation we need to clear up. Thank you.
Senator Baggage.
Thank you. And I want to be sure I understand too in that same point, and I think I do. Because the way you wrote the bill, it just simply says it will follow whatever the age is in the federal law. Simple as that. Is that basically
through the chair, yes, and I realize that was my mistake here. I'm looking at the slide that I presented, and it says will increase the age, not did. So I apologize for that. And that was entirely my fault, not Tristan's. He wrote it correctly in the slide.
Thank you.
All right. Any further questions before we go to finish up invited testimony? All right. We'll now go to invited testimony. We have Patrick Skinner, the attorney with the Alaska Disability Law Center. Mr. Skinner, are you with us?
Yes, Mr. Chair. My name is actually Patrick Stockton, but I am the attorney with the Disability Law Center of Alaska, and I believe I'm invited here today to talk about the ABLE bill.
All right. I'm sorry about that. I just had a different name written down here. Mr. Stocks, then, if you want to put yourself on the record, your affiliation, and provide your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Patrick Stocks. I'm a staff attorney with the Disability Law Center of Alaska, the Designated Protection and Advocacy System, PNA for short, protecting the rights of all Alaskans with disabilities. The Disability Law Center was involved in the advocacy that led to the passage of the Alaska ABLE Act in 2016. Every day, staff at the PNA talk to Alaskans with disabilities that have concerns about how they are going to remain eligible for benefits while pursuing the very things that stand to help make them productive and integrated members of the community, going to school, maintaining housing, or obtaining employment. For many of them, the answer is that they have an ABLE account, a tax-preferred savings vehicle that largely does not count against asset limits for Medicaid, SSI, and other public assistance programs for persons with disabilities. In our analysis, HB 133 is a good bill, which would, in practical effect, allow beneficiaries greater flexibility in making use of their savings, while at the same time tying key program requirements, including the required age of onset of disability, to the controlling federal statute. By amending the state ABLE statutes to link Alaska ABLE account requirements to federal law, as it may change and shift in the future, Alaskans with ABLE accounts would be able to immediately benefit from changes in law without waiting for new state legislation or regulation. This would in turn save precious legislative and agency rulemaking resources. HB 133 will also allow for more flexibility in how ABLE accounts are used, permitting rollovers from both ABLE and 529 accounts. This in turn would give individuals with disabilities greater control over how to save and spend for disability-related expenses. One of the recurring challenges to individuals with disabilities is the lack of individualized solutions and choices. This often leads to unwarranted segregation, separate classrooms where disabled students are grouped together, sheltered workshops where individuals with disabilities do not have the same employment opportunities as others, or universal accommodations that are not tailored to an individual's unique needs. Granting more flexibilities to make financial decisions allows Alaskans who use ABLE accounts greater personal autonomy and in turn a higher quality of life. The purpose of the ABLE Act is there in the ABLE acronym, achieving a better life experience. People can take a more active role in their community and face a lower risk of institutional care if they have greater flexibility to maintain their benefits while pursuing an education, engaging in the workforce, and saving for future needs and expenses. ABLE accounts allow Alaskans with disabilities greater autonomy to make decisions about education, transportation, employment, assistive technology, living expenses, healthcare expenses, and many other things. Allowing more flexibility in the ABLE program would be a positive thing for the Alaskans who use it. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, and I'd be more than happy to do my best to answer any questions the committee might have.
Thank you, Mr. Stocks. Any questions? No, thank you for what you do, and thank you for your testimony today. At this time, we'll open up public testimony. Anyone here in the room would like to testify on HB 133? Seeing none, and seeing no one online, we will close public testimony. Are there any final questions for the bill sponsor at this time? Senator Hughes.
So what we learned and cleared up today as far as the age, since it is a good idea for someone that might be age 27 to age 46, I would ask the sponsor, do you think it would be a good idea for us to encourage our congressional delegation to get back to work on that and raise that age?
Through the chair, Zach Fields, for the record, yes.
Thank you.
All right. At this time, we will set this bill aside. Please let us know if you have any amendments. Amendments are due on February 11th at noon to Ledge Legal, so we can then work with Ledge Legal on a timeline when those amendments might be ready, if there are any, so we can bring this bill back up for committee action. Thus, our next meeting will be Thursday. We will have the Executive Order 121, the bifurcation of the Health and Human Services Department. That time we'll hear from the department, and if there's still time, we may open up to public testimony, but we probably will do public testimony on that following Tuesday, the 15th. With that, are there any closing comments from committee members? Senator Baggage.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I just want to know what our timeline of the closing of amendments on this bill is for the 11th. When is our timeline for bringing it back up?
After we know what happens for amendments, and we could see what we can do.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right. See no other comments. We are adjourned at 2:15 p.m.